As we meet again this morning, we ask for your presence and for your help. Do guide us and lead us, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, we're moving today into topic number 20, which is Modern Missions 1. Topic 22 is Modern Missions 2, and I'll explain that division here in just a minute. One chart that is taken from Patrick Johnstone's book that I showed you last time, The Church is Bigger Than You Think, is a helpful chart on looking at major mission movements over the last 2,000 years. You can see within the early church in various directions, the Celtic Church, the Western and Central Europe, the so-called Nestorian Church and its labors in Asia, the Orthodox Church moving into Central Europe and Russia, the Catholic Church in Northern Europe. And then it's when we get to around the 1400s and 1500s, we see the Western missionary movement into the Americas and Asia. Similarly, the Russian Orthodox Church to Siberia and Alaska, the Moravians, and Protestant Evangelical. And I'm going to argue that it's helpful to see that whole phase as a continuous phase that we should call the modern missions movement. Actually, in two phases, beginning with the first one of the Roman Catholics in Spain and Portugal, in particular, going to the Americas and Asia, and then the Evangelicals and Protestants going later. So a helpful chart, and you'll note it. You see the global evangelical movement really in our day catching on, and that could inch back further. A lot of what's been happening on a global scale has happened unbeknownst to many of us in terms of cross-cultural missionary efforts, as we've talked about in Africa and elsewhere. Another set of maps which gives a bit of perspective on the modern missions movement. You see Roman Catholic missions from 1500 to 1800. The dark area in southern Europe shows what was traditionally Catholic. And then with the expansion of Spain into the Americas and the Philippines and influence of Roman Catholic missionaries spreading around Africa into various parts of Asia under Portuguese protection, and then later French protection, you see growth and inroads. It's hard to see the little marks around the coast of Africa. They are indeed little. Similarly in India, and then fairly widespread influence into China as Jesuit missionaries have significant influence in pockets there. When you look at 1792, why is the date 1792 chosen here? What happened in 1792? Yes. William Carey published this significant work, an inquiry into the means Christians had used to convert the heathen. And that, in a way, sets in motion the Protestant modern missions movement in the 1790s. But the dark period in Northern Europe, the dark area in Northern Europe, showing where Protestants were prominent, 1600, and then as the British Empire and Dutch trading influence spreads into the North American colonies and the Caribbean, some parts of Northern Latin America, Southern Africa, Australia, you see pockets of Protestant gains during the 17th and 18th centuries. Another chart here of some Protestant Roman Catholic missionaries. Names, many of these household names in the history of Christian missions. De las Casas, the Dominican Spaniard who eventually wakes up to the atrocities that the colonial authorities are committing against the Native Americans in Spanish America and starts to write and otherwise protest those abuses. Francis Xavier sees significant numbers of baptisms in India, what comes to be known then as Ceylon, current-day Sri Lanka, in the East Indies, and then comes to Japan in 1549, dies as he's longing to get into China in 1552, and there are Xavier churches worldwide, including at St. Louis University, if you go to downtown St. Louis, but one of the most widely known and beloved Roman Catholic missionaries in all of mission history. Skipping to Matteo Ricci in China, one of those influential Italian Jesuits who seemed to have the capacity and willingness to adapt to the particular situation. De Nobili in India did the same sort of thing. De Nobili adjusted to Brahmin ways of doing things. Matteo Ricci adjusted himself to the literari in China. And he helped set in motion what comes to be known as the Chinese rites controversy. That is, what should the Christian church do about venerating or worshiping, and the word you choose obviously is important, of the ancestors. And Matteo Ricci takes the posture that it's simply a civic duty. It's not a religious act. And it's only right for Christians to honor the ancestors by going through the particular rites that the Chinese literari observe. And the Catholic Church, under that sort of advice and leadership in China, abdicates that position, but there's controversy back and forth, and it depends on who are the superior generals within the Jesuits, who has influence in Rome, etc., etc. And finally, when some conservative French Jansenists gain particular influence in the 1700s in Rome, the Vatican brings down the ruling that Christians may not observe those rites. And when the Vatican's messenger conveys that message to the church in China in the late 1700s, as you can imagine, the Chinese emperor is not terribly pleased about that. And so the Catholic Church is therefore outlawed, and a period of relative flourishing peace is ended. And that remains to be a controversy amongst many Christians in the world about what to do about the ancestors. But Matteo Ricci is one who took a more liberal position, if you will, a generous position to what the context should say. Those are just a few of the prominent Roman Catholic missionaries in the modern missions movement. Now let me try to persuade you of why I think it's important to see what happens with the early Catholic missions, early modern times, starting about 500 years ago, why I think it's important to see that as part of the modern missions movement. In some ways, it can be a semantic distinction, and that's certainly not anything I want to die for or be arrogant about or even argue for in terms of a semantic distinction as to when the modern missions movement begins. Most of the literature that you will encounter talks about the modern missions movement really beginning with Carey in the 1790s. And that's one way to look at it. But it seems to me there are at least a couple of reasons for seeing the modern missions movement as a continuous movement starting 500 years ago. And these are the two reasons that seem to me to be helpful for seeing in that way. One, it's a movement that moves from the West outward. And as that happens under Spanish and Portuguese protection, and especially with the Spanish, as the Spanish propagate the faith in their newfound colonies in the Americas and the Philippines, that is out of the West. As Dutch and English traders begin to go out about coterminous with that, and then once we get to the 1790s, when you have Protestant missionaries as missionaries, and you have Moravians going out earlier, but when you have British missionaries and German missionaries and American missionaries going out to the rest of the world, that's from the West as well. And it's a continuous movement from the West to the non-Western world. And that's a continuum, I would suggest to you. And to see it as a continuum helps to explain how much of the non-Western world as a whole, speaking in generalities, wrestles with some of the same sorts of problems of contextualization, having received the Christian faith through various nations, Western nations, over the course of the past 500 years. That, to me, is one strong reason to see it as a continuum. Second, many of the issues, similar to one I just mentioned with the rights controversy, that the Roman Catholic missionaries face in their ministries, in the areas, whether it be in the Americas, East Asia, wherever it might be, many of the issues they face are the same ones that the Protestant missionaries face during the last two centuries. How do you adapt to the local setting? Or unwittingly, you see abuse, importation of culture, imperial gains, Christianity being associated with imperialism? Some of the same sorts of issues that are the dynamic beginning in, say, around 1500 are still being encountered once you're in the 19th and 20th century. Therefore, to see it as a continuum strikes me as helpful. Now, there are differences, and therefore to call them phase one and phase two also strikes me as helpful, because the second phase, as a Protestant phase, for example, stresses the translation of the Bible into the vernacular tongues. And that's a critical difference. Catholic missionaries are not doing that, really, until after Vatican II in the 1960s. And so that's one major difference that we see. All right. In thinking then briefly, and we are just going to think briefly, about this, what I want to call phase one of the modern missions movement, you know the notion, really, that's decided. It's a decision between some papal bulls and the Catholic and Portuguese crowns, that as far as Spain and Portugal are concerned, and as far as the Vatican is concerned, the non-European world is divided up into two parts. I mean, it's all non-European, non-Christian, heathen. But the heathen, non-Christian world is half Spain's, half Portugal's. And I don't have my world map up today because of my technical problems. But when you look at a world map and you just see the scope of that mentality that the crowns of Spain and Portugal had, you see how, a kind word, adventuresome that was. Yes? Not in terms of what the papal bull said. In terms of actual control that comes about, absolutely. Spain has the resources to conquer much of Central and South America and move on to the Philippines. And Portugal is only able to establish a few trading posts around Africa and India. But as far as the papacy was concerned, as far as the crowns were concerned, as they set out in their respective divisions, this half is Spain's, this half is Portugal's. And it only makes sense then. So when Christopher Columbus and others come on behalf, they plant the flag, claim this on behalf of the cross and of the Roman bishop. And that's just the way it works. It's not a totally uniform picture to where you have all the same views of people going. People like De las Casas, who are missionaries, object to what they see happening with some of the colonial rule. You have many of the Jesuits in Asia who have to be very careful with respect to what political and trading authorities have to say. And Jesuits who are working in China and in Japan and other parts of Asia, they slowly get intertwined with some of the silver trade and some of the silk trade, partly to support themselves financially. Missionaries who teach English in various settings today use that sort of a trade as well to help support themselves financially. But missionaries are wanting to be specifically religious in their work and aspirations. But they have to be careful about being intertwined, and many of them see the dangers and object to how political authorities want to impose their will without really understanding the situation. So it's a mixed bag of, especially when you talk about the Spanish scene, conquistadors who are going to conquer and rule, and missionaries, and of course different landowners who come into the scene as well, especially as far as the Spanish are concerned. It's helpful as well to recall that once we are in the late 1600s and 1700s, as Verkeil mentions in your readings, and I've listed here his pages 176 to 178, you have the Moravian missionaries who play important roles in formulating what missions is all about, who help to raise awareness amongst other Protestants eventually about the importance of all peoples around the world coming to hear the gospel. And of course it's Count Zinzendorf in the early 1700s who sets up his community at Hernhut, and many missionaries there are trained and sent out. Some missionaries sell themselves as slaves to go along to the Americas to minister. There are all sorts of creative ways that Moravian missionaries go out. Pietist missionaries associated go with, early on, and we'll see a chart to this effect, with the Danish Halle Mission as Lutheran Pietist missionaries, early on to India, really before Carey and the formal beginning of phase two of the modern missions movement begins. And so what's happening with these early Pietists and Moravian missionaries is very, very important, with their stress and zeal on the salvation of individuals. But when you think about what the mission strategy is of phase one of the modern missions movement, of what the Roman Catholic missionaries are about, and what really some of the early Protestant Reform missiologists are about, and there aren't very many, but when you look at what the missiological view is, it's basically to plant the church, to see the church take root and begun with all of its structures, all of its hierarchy, as an organization in these new lands. That's what missions is all about. And you've read about that in your readings, as I mentioned, with For Kyle. Any questions about phase one? I'm wanting to move ahead a little bit just to catch us up a bit. Yes? With the Spanish colonialism in the Americas and the Philippines, is the missionary's goal to start the church in particular? Yes. Of course, they see that as part of a wider Christian civilization being brought into these lands that need all of the benefits of the zenith of world civilization, which is Spain. And so all of the structures of government, of commerce, of the ecclesiastical orders, they are all to be brought to bear. But as the missionaries, they in particular have a focus on serving the Pope. And the Jesuits, you know, the Jesuits have a particular allegiance directly to the papacy. And that sometimes serves them when they need to act independently of colonial authorities, when some of them fight on behalf of indigenous peoples, for example. But it's part of a whole complex, but their particular focus is on establishing the church. Let's move then, and we're not going to spend a great deal amount of time here either, on to the next topic, topic 21, which is Latin America. And I would like to show you a couple of websites, but I can't due to technical difficulties, but I'll just tell you what they were as introductory material. These websites were taken from some articles in Christianity Today, speaking of some contemporary developments within Latin American Christianity. One was about increased cooperation between Pentecostals and evangelicals in Latin America. Likely you will know, and from your readings in Nunez, this will have been confirmed for you, that much of the significant growth in Latin American Christianity over the past decades has been amongst Pentecostal groups, varieties of Pentecostal groups. And I heard one mission leader put it this way. You'll also know about, in association with the development of liberation theology in Latin America in the 1970s and following, many Roman Catholic ecclesiastical leaders have latched on to liberation theology and sought to be more affiliated with the poor and suffering masses in Latin America and the developing base communities of these poor people. But as one mission leader put it, while the Catholic Church may have opted for the poor have opted for the Pentecostals, generally speaking. But this one article that I am unable to show you speaks of attempts at cooperation between Pentecostal groups and evangelicals, realizing that they really cannot ignore each other and that they both are sizable enough and growing to the extent and share enough to need to cooperate. Another article that I was going to show you speaks of how evangelicals in Latin America have grown to the point now to where many of them are more comfortable with consciously expressing being Latin Americans. This article speaks of how for many Latin American Christians, many of the forms of worship and church structure, church practice, church lifestyle, having come through Western missionaries, and in particular North American missionaries, has influenced them to the point to where they've had a struggle at being Latin American and being Christian at the same time. But with enough time having passed and having achieved enough growth and confidence, many of them now are incorporating Latin American styles of music and worship, etc. One D-Men dissertation that is being written now for Covenant Seminary is a pastor here in the States who grew up in Cuba, then Venezuela, and in recent years has gone to Mexico to do worship seminars. He's writing a dissertation evaluating how some of these churches have taken what he's given in these seminars and used those principles and contextualized them. And what he has discovered in his research is that different church leaders have different attitudes towards using, one, traditional Mexican music, and secondly, contemporary Christian music of the American variety. Contemporary Christian music with the American style is quite popular among many young people. Some church leaders say we definitely need to use it. Some are saying, no, we need to stick with the traditional hymns. That's what's holy and right and what the missionaries taught us. Few church leaders presently, so he's discovering, within the Presbyterian Church of Mexico, are ready quite yet to incorporate much traditional Mexican music. It has too many evil associations for them. Some are willing to go that route. But that is a present struggle, so this one dissertation is discovering. Now, I have some people who have roots and experience in Latin America here, and if you can ask or comment on that, and I'll ask for some of your further questions and comments as well. But yes. So comments out of Mexico, namely, that yes, there are struggles with worship, but in your experience, you didn't see really anyone attempting to incorporate, quote-unquote, traditional Mexican music. And again, this dissertation I mentioned, just a few people were in the name of kind of making worship like a fiesta and make it feel more at home. Some people are willing to do that. And then the further comment that much of what you saw was in line with what the readings were saying, and that is that many evangelicals there have a problem with living compartmentalized life with the religious sector of life and then the rest of life. And just to piggyback on that just a bit, from other people that I have read, Latin American theologians, and a couple of names, the Peruvian Samuel Escobar, Rene Padilla is an Argentine Baptist. Both of these men have written a number of articles and books, even in English. But they have been among those, a wide chorus of evangelicals in Latin America, who have said what liberation theology was trying to articulate in the 1970s wasn't all the way off the mark, in that much of what they were reacting against was a pietistic, compartmentalized, over-spiritualized Christianity that had been imported into Latin America from North America. And so they have been ones who have really helped to push the rest of the evangelical church to have social concerns, total life concerns as a part of the total theological agenda and matters of the Christian gospel, necessarily. I'm looking to my friend over here, too, for any questions or remarks in reaction to what we've covered so far, or as we move into the topic in general, where we are with Latin America. So,
yeah, I agree.
Would you share with the... we've done this before once, but would you remind the rest of the class your own experience with Latin America? So I'm going to repeat that for the sake of the tape briefly, just that you went back in 1978, there for 20 years, and when you first went in the late 70s, Protestants, Evangelicals, Pentecostals, and all, they were all lumped together in terms of terminology and understanding. They would tend to be marginalized, not terribly significant, but over the course of the past 20 years, there's been significant growth amongst Protestants, Evangelicals, Pentecostals, and now there's respect, there's influence, and continuing growth amongst those groups. Thank you. And I'm going to welcome any further comments. I want to read something that you did not get to read. The readings that you had out of Nunez were from this book, Crisis and Hope in Latin America, co-authored by Emilio Nunez and William Taylor. William Taylor is editor of another book I have you perusing. You're reading a couple of essays by Samuel Escobar in connection with an assignment, and that's on reserve for you in the library. But this is from the foreword by Samuel Escobar. It may sound as a typical Latin American exaggeration to say that the future of Christianity is at stake in what happens in Latin America today. But, he says, when we pay attention to figures, we may have to conclude that there is no exaggeration in that statement, that the future of Christianity really is at stake, depending on what happens in Latin America. Almost half of the Catholics of all the world live in Latin America. I heard someone in passing or somehow mention the other day that somehow there was rumors or something like that that maybe the next pope could be Latin American. Can you imagine what that would be? Well, if you think about the numbers and you think about the papacy's desire to make sure that Latin America remains Catholic, whatnot, that would be an interesting step. Consequently, the Catholic hierarchies consider the region as a reservoir of human and material resources for their missionary work in the future. Another side comment on this. I think this came up in your readings as well. In fact, I'm sure it did. Latin America, especially 100 years ago, was somewhat of an anomaly for the Protestant missionary force. Because was it Christianized or was it not Christianized? And at the 1910 Edinburgh Missionary Conference, for example, due to the long-standing Catholic presence there, it was basically considered to be Christianized in comparison to Africa in Asia. Now, some of those views have changed in light of especially North American missionary activity in the 20th century, perhaps. But at the same time, Latin America, again in comparison to, and the Philippines fits in the same category, has been viewed differently missiologically than many parts of Africa and Asia by Western Christian agencies and churches. On the other hand, on the heels of speaking of Roman Catholicism, Latin America happens to be the continent where popular forms of Protestantism grow faster than anywhere else, and they grow at the expense of the Catholic Church. During the most recent decades, more people have left Catholicism in order to become Protestant than at the time of the Reformation in the 16th century. That's really interesting to think about, isn't it? You know, the Reformation in Europe is so terribly significant for our very identities, those of us here. But you think about what's happening in Latin America and the sheer numbers of people there, so claimed here, greater. Brazil, with its population of over 140 million, is considered the largest Catholic nation in the world, but the Catholic percentage of the population went down from 92.8% in 1970 to 88.4% in 1980, and decline has continued. In fact, the 22 million Protestants of Brazil might well be now a religious majority in comparison with the number of Catholics who actually practice their religion. I don't have the stats on that, and I don't have with me some of the graphs and stats I've been given about the numbers of Brazilian missionaries going out within Brazil to new people groups and indeed around the world. I was just speaking yesterday with a gentleman on our campus who is currently ministering in Mozambique, former Portuguese colony. And he is interested, for example, in recruiting Brazilian missionaries to come minister in Mozambique. Mission to the World has sought to see Brazilian missionaries go minister in Portugal and other similar sorts of places in the world. So the significant growth of Protestant Christianity. In your readings, you did just the part on the spiritual dimensions about the Catholic Church and the evangelicals. Those of you who will be taking the elective course will be reading what the book sets forth as a contemporary panorama and a synopsis of history. I've just included those outlines for you in the syllabus to note when you look at Latin America, You have to remember the tremendous variety of peoples and nations and histories there, and religious heritages. And again, we, for convenience sake, we speak in lump terms of Asia, Africa, Latin America, etc. But there's just a tremendous variety of peoples in Latin America. Then the geography, mountains, forests, beaches, etc. And I'm sure in Argentina, you will have seen a variety of geography that most of us who haven't been there would not be able to imagine would be there. Varieties of races, the huge population explosion in many places, the ever-changing and interesting political scenarios in countries, the religious scenarios, the Catholics, the Catholic mix, the varieties of new religious movements springing off of Catholicism, and then the varieties of Protestantism and Pentecostalism, etc., and the rich cultures of music and dance and craft, etc. And then when you look at history, the way they talk of history here is pre and post 1492. We have to remember that this is helpful for looking at history, but we have to remind ourselves that this part of the world had significant strands of history prior to 1492, if we're going to really think in a multipolar world historical sort of a way. Side note to this, if you like history, the funniest book ever written is one written by a couple of Brits in the 1930s entitled 1066 and All That. Any of you know that book? It is just the funniest. If you like history, and if you know British history in particular, you will just be crying out of laughter in reading that book. Someone graciously gave me a copy recently, and I read it earlier. And even though I don't know British history as well as I should, I could get some of the humor in that. And for example, they talk about, just, and it reminded me of what I was just talking about in light of when it speaks of India. It begins the chapter by noting in a tongue-in-cheek way, Indian history begins in the 1700s when they start fighting wars for the British. And if we're not careful, you know, we can think in those sorts of ways, including about Latin America. But with the coming of the Spaniards, obviously things change with all of the conquest and the colonization that takes place. Your readings pointed out to you, and if some of you remember Neil Hageman coming to campus last year, he stressed this in his lectures on Latin America. It's not all Roman Catholic missionary activity in Latin America. In the mid-16th century, in the 1500s, you have various Protestants coming in association with Dutch and British attempts at establishing trading posts. And that's important to remember, that Protestant history goes back to the mid-16th century. And some of those attempts failed and some succeeded just a bit. But French Huguenots, for example, went there. And Nunez mentions that in what she read, as I recall. But the various revolutions and independence gained in the early 19th century, the new republics formed, therefore, the development that occurs in the late 19th, early 20th century, and then the instability that many nations have experienced in Latin America. And then when you look at all the various spiritual dimensions of which you've read, tremendous activity, tremendous vitality, and just worldwide significance for what's happening with respect to the Christian faith in Latin America. And again, this should be a help to us in realizing where the mission field is. It's the whole world. And the Christians in Latin America are about working out their salvation in fear and trembling, just as we are in this part of the world or everywhere else. And they are involved in sending out missionaries in a cross-cultural way, whether it be within their countries or outside their political entities as well. I would welcome any further comments on the readings or this brief overview from those of you who have experience in Latin America that you think would be helpful to us. Anything you would like to add? So the huge testimony to the huge crusades and important evangelists that have arisen in that setting. I mean, Louis Palau is a name that's perhaps more familiar to people worldwide in English-speaking circles as well, of a widespread, prominent evangelist. All right, let's move then to Modern Missions 2. And by this, again, I'm meaning what is occurring really since the 1790s in particular. Phase two of the modern missions movement or the Western missionary movement might be one other way to look at it. A couple of maps that you have in your syllabus. Protestants in 1865. You see areas in, based on a map we saw earlier, in 1792 in northern and northwestern Europe, in the North American colonies, pockets of South American Australia, you have Protestants with a significant presence by 1792, but over the course of the next, 70 years, you see Protestant advances across what is now the United States, in southern Africa with the English and the Dutch and the activity there, in the Indian subcontinent, and further into Australia in association with colonial expansion. Side note to North America. Some people have noted that when you get right down to evaluating what has been called the great century in Christian missions, namely the 19th century, perhaps the single most significant occurrence of Christian advance in the 19th century is the spread across the North American continent of the Christian church in connection with the growth of the United States of America. Then when you look at by 1910, you see further growth into Eastern Europe and in parts of Central Asia, further into China, Australia, pockets of South America. And again, this will be association largely with British missionary expansion and some other European countries becoming involved as well in colonial expansion throughout the world. When you look at some prominent Protestant missionaries, there will be some familiar names for many of you. John Eliot, coming to England to the North American Indians in New England, a congregational missionary with the Society of Propagation of the Gospel in New England. Thomas Bray, similarly, this as an Anglican. Ziegenbalg, one of those early German Lutherans who goes to India in the early 1700s with the Danish Halle Mission, David Brainerd, the young zealot who dies in his zeal of giving himself no rest in his concern that Native Americans actually come to hear the gospel. Christian Friedrich Schwartz is another one of those Lutheran pietists who goes to India in the 1700s with the Danish Halle Mission. And then there's William Carey, and you know the story of his being a shoe cobbler, and he comes as he's hearing about the adventures of Captain Cook in the Pacific and becoming more aware of the needs of work, people around the world. He becomes concerned and he becomes convinced that Christians need to do something about that. And there's the anecdotal story that, as someone has noted, if it isn't actually true, it ought to be true, when he's in a meeting of ministers and Carey says, there's something that we have to do about this. And the old minister says, young man, if God wants us to do something, he'll do it himself. Sit down and be quiet. And that shows some of the ethos and thinking that was the prominent thinking for Protestants, that the early apostles had fulfilled the Great Commission. And what do we need to do about that? But William Carey spearheads, and he writes his inquiry into the means that should be used, that Christians should be all about what they do. And Carey, of course, goes to India and turns out to be a tremendous linguist, educator, and rightfully seen to be the pivotal seminal figure that he was. Henry Martin is another Englishman, and he is an Anglican who goes to India and then Persia. Robert Morrison, another Anglican, this time with the London Missionary Society. And that's really, you have the Baptist Missionary Society associated with the Independents. You have the London Missionary Society, which helps send many others out, including Anglicans. And you have the Church Missionary Society, which is specifically associated with the Anglicans out of England. the first American missionary to go out, Adoniram Judson, as he goes out and settles in Burma, now Myanmar. And you'll know the story how he really helps to found the American Board of Commissioners for the Foreign Missions, which is associated with Congregationalists in England. En route, on ship, he gets convinced of Baptist teaching, becomes a Baptist, and the folks back home aren't really happy about that. But Baptists are very happy about that, and you'll see all sorts of Judson colleges around this country named after Adoniram Judson. Robert Moffat, Alexander Duff, the great missionary scholar out of Scotland, who went from the Church of Scotland to India, and thankfully Samuel Crowther listed here. That young boy taken out of the Niger region as a slave, relocated by the British in Sierra Leone, and Samuel Crowther leads the cross-cultural missionary effort, several of them, into present-day Nigeria. Yes? He is. When you turn the page, continued, here he comes. Glad you asked. That was not a setup. David Livingstone, of course, and his travels into the interior of Africa. When you get to about the 1850s, and we'll see a chart to this effect in a minute, you start to see different missionaries start to move into interior areas. Much of that is simply because it becomes more feasible to do so practically. If you try to go inland at all prior to that, you're going to die of disease or get killed, one or the other. But so Livingstone really is a trailblazer in that sense. John Patton, very important Scottish missionaries in the South Pacific. And there are all sorts of heroic stories of missionaries from Britain and from France and from the United States in the Pacific Islands in the 1800s, leading to the widespread growth of the gospel to where you have whole populations coming to Christianity throughout the Pacific Islands. And many stories of martyrs and cannibals eating missionaries, and those fire the imagination further of what it means to be a missionary in the Pacific. We've run across John Nevius already, who really implements in Korea the three-self formula, churches needing to be self-governing, self-propagating, self-supporting, and that those ideas were enunciated and articulated earlier by Henry Venn in England and Rufus Anderson in America, and then Hudson Taylor, who founds the China Inland Mission. And in connection with Taylor, you have the Guinness family, who in various places in Africa and otherwise support the founding of what come to be known as faith missions. This is where faith missions really begin and where people again start to go inland. Faith missions being to where you don't have a church structure to support you financially. You don't go around asking for money to support you. You believe God and you go. And you trust God to provide. And you'll know the story of Hudson Taylor as well, how he seeks to become Chinese. The other missionaries just cannot understand this really eccentric figure. And he rubs him the wrong way. But his autobiography and biography is about him, and he becomes one of those heroic missionary figures who is just captures many imaginations due to the hagiography written about him. Mary Slessor is another important missionary who in West Africa moves inland, again in present-day Nigeria, and she is a name that in Nigerian church history stands out amongst the most prominent, and she, against the advice of many, chooses to move inland, saying that I'm not a threat. People aren't going to consider me dangerous. And is able to blaze many trails. C.T. Studd, that interesting figure, famous cricketer, who leaves it all and goes to join the China Inland Mission, then goes to India, then it sets up his own mission eventually in Africa, the Heart of Africa Mission. And Albert Schweitzer, the famous medical doctor, working in French Equatorial Africa from Germany. So just a list of some of the names. We look at these more extensively in the history of a World Mission Elective Class. Couldn't see. This mentioning another missionary into West Africa, this is not meant to be an extensive list to list everyone. It just picks out some of those that are prominent. Yes. Yeah. I'm sure that when they compiled this list, they just had to select a few that people would be particularly familiar with. As you read Verkhyl and about the development of mission theory, I want to stress from that, from Verkhyl, the importance of mission theory is developed by various missiologists. Gustav Warneck in Germany, a very seminal missions thinker and researcher. As far as Dutch missiologists, certainly Bavinck in our Reformed tradition is extremely important. And as I noted earlier when mentioning his book, Introduction to the Science of Missions, many of us cut our theological teeth on Bavinck. Henrik Kramer, listed on Verkhyl's page 41, very important worldwide figure and influential, especially in the 1930s and 1940s, when the worldwide Christian movement is starting to wrestle significantly with non-Christian religions, etc. Kramer takes a relatively conservative, Bardian, but on the scale on which he's operating, conservative posture for the uniqueness of the Christian religion amongst other Christian religions. And many people had trouble accepting that sort of a position. Page 51 of Verkhyl, Hoekendijk, another important Dutch missiologist, and as he's writing in the 1960s, he's taking a rather radical stand that the church as we know it needs to disappear and allow for the modern secular age to come forward, and the church will find itself as it loses itself in the midst of all the interesting thinking going on in the 1960s. English missiologist. I'll tell you what, I'm going to stop here and we'll pick back up because we have a guest that I want to bring up. But I'll just show you, and we'll come back to it next time in closing right here. A chart that touches on some of the missionaries we just considered. This is by Ralph Winter, and looking at the what he calls the three eras of the modern missionary movement. You should have this in your syllabus. But we talked about the inland missions that really start in the mid-19th century. And this chart talks about how when you look at what was happening from the 1790s for the next 100 years, basically missionaries are going to the coastlands. Then in the mid-19th century, you see people start going to the inlands. And then beginning in the 1930s with Donald McGavern and Cam Townsend, we'll talk more about them, you see people start to crystallize the notion of unreached peoples. And that's the stage, and that's the final stage of missions that we're in. So this analysis tells us. We'll come back to this. I just wanted to refer to it now briefly because it systematizes a bit some of the missionaries we were considering earlier. All right, we have a guest, and I'm going to ask him to come up, or them to come up, depending on how they're going to do it. And it's a treat for us to have Mark and Marty Milan, who are MTW missionaries in France. And we are friends from going through different MTW things together and have remained in touch, and they are back in the States for home ministry assignment. They're in St. Louis for a missions conference at Good Shepherd Presbyterian Church. And they've been gracious enough to come by and share with us a bit here in class.
Nelson asked me to speak a bit about missions in France and Europe, really. You know, we know other missionaries in Europe. I know more, have more experience about missions in France. It could start when Marty and I arrived in 1994. We started in Paris with the language school. And as soon as we were up and running and able to speak to people and understand some of the responses in French, I went around and I asked as many people as I could what advice they'd have for me, a new missionary, or new, didn't use the word missionary so much, a new pastor, because in France they have a tradition of pastors. The Reformation from Calvin was started and then really declined through the wars of religion, but still in French society and culture, they kind of can understand what a pastor is. So I asked, what advice would you have for me, a new pastor, just starting a ministry in France? I got, as you can imagine, all sorts of responses and suggestions. And I asked missionaries, pastors, and business people, lay people, believers, non-believers. I was at a wedding not long after we were in France, about a year after we arrived, and asked a businessman that was seated next to me at the reception, Henri. And I asked Henri, what advice would you have? And he said two things that always stuck with me. He explained his own background, his experience with the church. He was raised in a Jesuit school, and I learned a French phrase, il a bouffé du curé. I don't know if any of you speak any French, but he's stuffed with priests. he's had it up to here with them. He explained why and why he left the church himself. And he said that when he was a young boy, he was positive towards the church. And the village priest, he would come around and visit them in their home. And he would always, it's kind of folkloric, the kind of the chubby parish pastor who, or a priest who would come. And he'd always arrive at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock. And they would forcibly be invited to stay for lunch. And he spent that time with people. And to this fellow Henri, that's the distant past. That religion, church has become a business, it's become an industry, it's become anything but just kind of personal. So he said that is the one reason that he's distanced himself from the church. And the other was that the church is now involved in politics and social activities and education and everything but the spiritual. It was kind of surprising, really ironic for me to be hearing this from a fella who is, and his friends, our common friends, would just describe him as a hardened cynic, businessman, a materialistic. But what he missed in the church, what he didn't find in the church, was the spiritual. And the circumstances of this wedding and the reception were that our friends, our common friends, were having the wedding in a neighboring village, not their own village, because their local village priest is communist. And our friends, Michel was the president of the Chamber of Commerce, so you can imagine that he didn't really get along with the communist priest. Which goes to show that when the church was no longer offering what people wanted, and personal, spiritual, and as Marty and I arrived in France, we thought, well, we can do that. we can spend time with people at wedding receptions and cafes and restaurants in our home, in their homes, and spiritual, that we do have a message of reconciliation to offer. Sometimes I am tempted to, and people want to hear about the politics and economics, and they want to talk about the death penalty. They want to talk about American things, and it's tempting to go that route because we would have lots to say about that, but we don't want to take positions that would offend people on those issues and that would limit the hearing that we have with people regarding the gospel and reconciliation. That kernel of the gospel, of practicing reconciliation, having the truth of the gospel. Yeah, we need to be orthodox, we're reformed, we understand the culture, the world. Those things are essential, but then also we need to do that in a way that is personal and spiritual, in a way that is really relevant. And I think in Europe, at least what I've seen in France, it's and we've learned in seminary the inspiration, the authority of Scripture, but it's the relevancy of the gospel, the relevancy of Scripture. Is the Bible something that I can use in my relationship with my family, with my my wife, my children? Those are the things that we have found to be really useful in our ministry. Now, my weakness is I have trouble seeing the big picture, and there are other people that do that kind of thinking in the think tanks and the addressing the biggest issues in culture. So far, we have just a personal ministry with some neighbors, with some friends of friends. And those are the points that people really have wanted to know. We haven't gotten so much into textual criticism, higher or lower criticism, there are some people that ask those kind of questions, and I'm glad for my seminary experience. I forget if Nelson had said that I graduated from Covenant Seminary about 10 years ago. So at that point, there was just one missions class. And what I did that served me, I think, in my experience here at seminary was that I took as many missions courses, well, just the one missions course, but I took as many church planning courses as I could, because that's what we were headed for, church planning. So I took courses with Phil Douglas and did as much as I could with that practically to understand the principles and have them clear enough to me so that then I could apply those principles in a different context culturally and sort out the difference between what is cultural and what is those universal principles. The next thing I would like to say in that is that regarding our mission work in France, it's really, yeah, it is the church, as Nelson said, but the church isn't really marketable in France. It's not, as one missionary told me, don't come to Paris and expect people to line up to come to your Bible studies and your small groups and church. You know, the French, they just kind of shrug, and we're there. We're all excited that we have all these people behind us praying for us, and we're prepared and sent out to be missionaries. And the French are just kind of, so what? They're not really interested in coming to church, but they are really interested in sitting down over a cup of coffee and talking and speaking. And people will say all kinds of things. And in that sense, I would say ministry in Europe, or presumably ministry in Paris, is like ministry in the States. It's personal. People have needs. When they know how much you care, well, then they'll care what you know. Those kind of things really are true. It's that personal, loving, not churchy. Church is not real. It's just they don't have the cultural repairs. They don't have the cultural context to put church into. Asking somebody to church, like I grew up in northeastern Maryland, I just didn't know many Muslims, or I didn't know any Jews. So the idea of going to a Jewish Seder meal was just kind of, I had no idea. You know, even if I would have heard about one, I wouldn't have gone, because it didn't mean anything. That wasn't my, I grew up in a nominal Christian, really not understanding the gospel. So I just, those activities, I didn't have that cultural insight. And I think many of us perceive that as antagonism or aggressiveness from the French. But as I've been there for these last, we've had 7 years now that we've been involved with ministry in France, I can understand from their point of view, their suspicions towards organized religion. They would go back to the Crusades, the wars of religion, all kinds of events that have happened that fortify and explain their position of being suspicious of organized religion. They would go back to September 11th and how religious extremism can cause all sorts of problems. And so they want to be prudent, they want to be cautious, but at the same time, they really do have spiritual needs and spiritual interests. And we see our job as meeting those as we can and getting in touch with them, and then really having something that we would be able to offer them, the reconciliation of Jesus Christ. So I don't know, do we need to stop there, or I could just... Okay. Yes. Excuse me, is there any kind of renewal in the church? Yes. There are some churches we know that... The Vineyard movement sent some people over, and it was kind of messy. That was just one church I know of in the south of Paris. There is the Toronto Blessings. There's a big movement in the Catholic Church. It can mean all kinds of things. I had a pen pal when I was in high school and went and visited with her father, and she told me that her son, my pen pal's husband, his son-in-law, was charismatic. Oh, great! Well, I have to meet him and find out. Well, it turned out he plays the guitar in church. That's the nature of his charismatic expression. So, it means all kinds of different things. That's something else that I didn't understand really until going to the charismatic or the Catholic Church. Sometimes as Protestants, we're kind of embarrassed because we're all divided up into all these different movements. And it's hard to explain. Well, the Catholic Church is it seems to me, from the outside, I just don't get it either. It's just as eclectic that we have a friend who's, oh yeah, she's Catholic. She disagrees with the Pope. She never goes to confession. She just likes this church, that church. You know, she takes this and that. And well, then she says she's Catholic. Well, so things. I guess that's the other thing in ministry in France, probably in Europe. You have to get underneath the surface to really find out what things mean. I think we jump so quickly once we have labels that we think we understand, or even a translation that we think we understand, and doesn't necessarily mean what we think it means. Right. Okay, the question was kind of the traditional French perspective, particularly on the church and the gospel, compared to African and also the Sri Lankans and the French Caribbean islands, the Antilles, that are in France. From what I've seen is I really haven't seen any churches growing in France amongst the call them Français de souche, the root French, the European French. There are some churches that grow a little bit here and there. There are particularly two charismatic churches in Paris that have had tremendous growth. We'll see how long lasting that is. But in terms of reproducible growth, it's really uniquely, as far as I can see, uniquely amongst minority groups. For different reasons, but they're uprooted, they're not at home, and they come to France, and then they're more open to things. But even in the Caribbean islands, that's where there's about 1,700 churches in the Caribbean islands, and that's just a huge, it's about five times more per capita in those islands than there are in France, in the continent. The Holy Spirit is working amongst many from Africa that are in France. All the churches we go to, the ones that are growing, they're growing amongst Africans and non-continental French. And that's one of the puzzles that we have in ministry in France. I imagine it's like that elsewhere in Europe. Do we work with those that the Spirit seems to be working in and bringing to us? I have one Lutheran pastor who told me, well, you know, the French people, God has rejected them, and because they've rejected God. And French people are going to hell. He told me when I came to France, we'll just go back to America and have a ministry of encouragement, of teaching God's blessing and preaching God's blessing. Don't stay in France where the message of the gospel, if it's going to be true to the gospel in France, he told me, it's preaching God's rejection of people that have rejected him. So, of course, I don't believe that's what what the gospel is. That Jesus Christ has taken all that condemnation. And so we can really offer the peace of God that Christ has earned. But it's not universally understood that way. Yes? The question is, do we have some contact with the gypsies in France? Probably the most contact we have with them is when we see them outside our home, or they come and knock on our door sometimes to sell something. We've heard, again, it's just, you know, things, figures that you read, half of the gypsies in France have been converted to the gospel. They have huge 60,000 people get together on airfields and have revival meetings and camp meetings. I don't know, but there certainly is still not integration of them into the rest of the church, the rest of the Protestant church or Reformed church. Thank you.